Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Imagine a world of grand large trees, a deciduous forest that covers much of the East Coast with giant 120-foot behemoths with trunks of 6, 10, 12, and 15 feet and more in diameter. Then imagine them gone. We talk about the great American chestnut forest, their past, and their hope-filled future when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wildside News. In the past 401 years since Pocahontas and John Smith met, much has happened to our American lands. In many cases, the departure of our forests and wild places has come with the advances of the modern world, and in some cases, nature herself played a role. That is the case with the story of the great American chestnut forests. It is a story now of hope, thanks to a small group of dedicated chestnut lovers who are growing into a mature forest of hope. Joining us now from Bennington, Vermont, is one of my better friends. We go back a long ways. We're a couple of true nature guys, grew up with it. We have a lot in common. Marshall Case is the president of the American Chestnut Foundation. Marshall, welcome to the Wildside News.
Good to be back in touch, Sydney. I think we did the first program together. You used me as your guinea pig.
That's what friends are for.
That's right. Well, we still know how to roll up our pant legs and wade out catching frogs together. That's what counts in life.
Well, I wish there were a few more frogs. They're harder to find right now, and that's part of why we keep working so hard.
They are disappearing faster than we can log them in the new territories.
That's really sad, because you're a frog guy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Particularly the tree kind, the hylas. I like the hylas the most.
Well, speaking of trees, that seems to be one of the main foci of your life these days. And you're the president of the American Chestnut Foundation. And for people who aren't aware of that, why don't you give us an overview of what you're up to?
Well, we have a modest job to restore 4 billion American chestnut trees to the eastern forest ecosystem. For those who aren't familiar with the story, in the early 1900s, a blight fungus came in on Asian nursery stock. It was discovered in 1904 at the Bronx Zoo on some trees that were planted there. And within a 50-year period, this fungus had stretched its way north to the Canadian border and south to Georgia, Alabama, west of the Ohio River Valley, and knocked out the most dominant tree ever in the eastern hardwood forest called the American chestnut. So our job is to find the science and get enough genes for resistance built into the tree material they're working with right now so that we can restore American chestnut to the forest ecosystem here in the east.
The American chestnut tree was a truly dominant tree and created a magnificent forest, one that very few Americans have any concept of and have had no experience ever seeing. Why don't you give us a sense of what that forest was like, because it was a very impressive space.
It was approximately 25% of all the eastern forest on average, and these trees could get to a height of 120 feet, and it was not uncommon to have a diameter of 6 feet up to 12 feet in forest, particularly in the central and southern part of the Appalachians, so from Pennsylvania down to particularly to western North Carolina into eastern Tennessee. And in fact, in western North Carolina, there's a tree from the root collar that was left, not the standing tree, that was 17 and a half feet in diameter, which is kind of hard to believe. These trees are also called the redwoods of the east because they had a high tannin content, and once they were down, used for building materials, for sills in a house, or railroad ties, telephone poles, they lasted a long time. In fact, there's still some American chestnut trees in service have one out on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. I think it was put in service back around 1917 and is still there in the Chatham area out near the eastern end of Cape Cod. So it was called a cradle-to-grave tree. You could do everything with it. And it was a veneer. It was structurally the best wood you could have, lighter and stronger than oak. And it also, of course, supplied a huge amount of nuts each fall. About 50%, a little bit more than 50% of all of the nuts that you would collect on a forest floor on average were American chestnuts. So with the demise of the tree, that resulted in a crash of a lot of the wildlife populations. And it was a tree that actually sustained villages and mountain communities. And when it was gone, many of these mountain people had to move to, you know, city areas, find jobs elsewhere, because this tree actually sustained their entire life.
Do we have an idea of how old some of those the old growth chestnuts were?
Well, we know they got to be 400 years. That's the one number that I've seen. In the literature. So a 400-year-old tree, maybe more than that, but at least a 400-year-old.
Phenomenal trees. I encourage people to go to the website and see some historic pictures of some of the trees. They're fascinating. Well, that was then, and this is now. At this point, are there any mature chestnut forests available for people to visit?
No, there are a few on private property, but they're beyond the original range of the blight. So in other words, the trees that were carried, nuts that were carried by pioneers that went beyond the original range, and I'm talking right now one specific area up in northwest Wisconsin, close to where you and I visited that time. We drove over across the Mississippi together, and up in La Crosse, Wisconsin, so going toward the central northern part of the state, there has been a self-generating forest there, but unfortunately blight found its way into it probably about 10 years ago. We've got ongoing studies at that site. We actually have leases on the property with the farmers in order to protect the trees from being taken down for, you know, commercial use, because it's a very valuable tree. Even in the state of being dead, it's what's called wormy chestnut, and it's a very highly prized wood now for interior decorating, paneling, and that kind of thing. So we've been studying this, but aside from that, and several others in Michigan and one or two in Wisconsin, small forested areas, all on private land. There are no chestnut forests left in the original range. And there are individual trees, and that's one of our jobs, is to seek out a tree that gets beyond the flower, to or beyond the flowering point, and does not get attacked immediately by the blight. And when we find a tree like that, we try to eat the fungus by getting the pollination from our advanced genetic material that we're growing on our research farms in Virginia, and get the male pollen onto the female flowers on those trees so that we can capture the genetics by getting a nut harvest before fungus kills them. And that's part of our program in developing a statewide chapter network. We now have 13 state chapters and a huge network of volunteers who are out in the field looking for trees, and then if one is found and it gets to the flowering state, they help with the pollination, the harvest, and then the beginning of an orchard program where you're growing new trees up from these nuts in order to continue to protect the biological diversity that still remains within the original range. So there are a lot of sprouts that come up from the old root collars, the old root systems, but hardly any of those, and there are millions of those, and hardly any of those ever get to the point where they flower, because they're attacked by the blight within 3 to 5 years, or by the time they get to be maybe 12 to 15 feet in height.
You've been working on research to develop a resistant strain. How is that progressing?
Actually, we made very good progress. We're within three seasons, I guess, now, of having the first nuts from what we think will be very highly resistant material. These will be very small numbers, of course, to start with. And it's a matter of time now. We're trying to build additional genes for resistance. We know we have two or three genes for resistance to the blight, but we know once we get our material out in the forest that the fungus will do everything it can to overcome what we're throwing at it, for lack of a better term. And so the more genes we can build into our science that can resist the fungus, the long-term solution. So we're still a long window. We're looking at, I would say, for trees that will be blight-resistant and, say, 100 feet in height, maybe 12 inches in diameter, we're looking 50 years out. So it's a long view, and but that's part of what you do in science. There are really no quick fixes to a solution like this. The great news is that if and when this happens, we're pretty confident it will, it'll be the greatest comeback story, you know, bringing a species back from the brink of extinction. So it's very encouraging, and it's why a lot of people are getting involved, because they see the hope connected to it. It's not a last-minute crash save this. It's a long view. The science is working. This can be done. And once we restore it, it benefits lots of things, you know, wildlife, forest health, even purifying the air and the water. This tree has many capabilities.
I heard recently that you are working closely now with the U.S. Forest Service on long-range plans for reintroduction.
Yeah, that's been a major breakthrough for us. Probably 7-8 years ago, we weren't really taken that seriously by the science community in general. And there were people who were paying attention to what we were doing and very intrigued by it, but I thought this was maybe more of a mom-pa kind of an operation by a small nonprofit that would sizzle. Not so. We've developed material now to the point where the USDA Forest Service came to us a little over a year ago. Chief Dale Bosworth and some of his Forest Health Section scientists, and we sat down with him in Washington and at their invitation, and he was so impressed with, first of all, our network of citizen scientists, our volunteers through the chapter network, and what he could see Chestnut could do again for forest health, that within a year we had a signed agreement. And it's basically a 30-year window with them. So we're looking at 3 10-year phases, and we're working directly with their science team in the field, with their staff geneticists that coordinate the two different regions in the east, and then right on the ground with the Forest Service units. And the plan is to consistently stay out ahead of where we need to be next. So by that I mean looking at early forest trials. We get some material that we think is going to be very good, but we don't want to broadcast it yet because we're not sure how well it's going to do under natural conditions. And so we'll work with various units of the Forest Service to put these experimental plots out with modest numbers of advanced blight-resistant seed and see how they do in these natural conditions. And from that we'll learn more about the second phase as we get into the second 10-year period with them on how to then begin some small trials in larger areas. And the step up is to get within a roughly a 30-year window with the Forest Service. We want to get to the point where we have material available to the public. And that's the goal. We want to protect the science, do the best job we can, but have some kind of a realistic window where there will be material in the hands of the public, and they can begin to experiment, help with the larger reforestation program.
Now, there's sort of two approaches. One is just the literal reforestation to bring the chestnut back into its original native groves and areas, but as well there is a sort of an applied science to utilizing and realizing that the chestnuts can serve a role in carbon sequestration,
right,
which is the capturing of carbon, which is so important right now in terms of global warming. And then as well, there's visions of utilizing the chestnut for reforesting areas that have been essentially devastated due to strip mining of coal. Why don't you talk about some of those visions?
The carbon sequestration is probably the easier one. First of all, for those people who don't know about this, and I didn't know about it, probably until 6-7 years ago, there's something called carbon credits. So in the utility industry, if you have older generating plants, say in the Ohio River Valley, and they're not meeting the standards for the, you know, the U.S. Air quality standards, you can buy land, as an example, in Bolivia, and you buy 1 million or 2 million acres of forested area in Bolivia. Those trees are putting pure air out from that area. And so that's considered an offset to the problem that's being created by the utility company, say, in the Ohio River Valley. So it's an offset, carbon credits, they call them. The good thing, and looking to the future, the good thing about American chestnut is that it grows through science studies we've done at this area up in Wisconsin we were speaking about a few minutes ago, we know that chestnut will grow 2 to 2.5 times faster than any other hardwood tree in the ecosystem in the East. So that means that they can sequester carbon, or it's a carbon sink. You know, they can actually capture it and store it to a level where planting more chestnut gives you more carbon sink, and therefore you're helping with the overall air standard issue. And we have the science to back that up, so it's a matter of time when we can get numbers of trees out there to begin to, you know, help the formula. We go over to the strip mine areas, the coal fields, which in a lot of areas, you know, they're like a moonscape. Under the original guidelines, following up on the years when the strip mining issue was being dealt with, particularly by environmental groups, but the regulations actually had the land after it was stripped being built into a kind of a grassland. So you would compact the soil and kind of encapsulate the areas that had been stripped. And then in order to get that soil to hold without a lot of erosion, they were planting very aggressive grass species, which are about the best thing for trying to keep the soil from eroding. The problem was that they came into a situation with almost like concrete. The water would get down, it would run off. The grass species were not good for our native wildlife. You know, there are a lot of problems with that. So we've been doing some early, when I say we, Chestnut Foundation's come into this formula fairly recently. The University of Kentucky in particular, working with the Office of Surface Mining and their regulatory unit, have been doing some experimental plantings in parts of Kentucky, particularly eastern Kentucky. And with the early material, this goes back about 9 years, and with some of our chestnut material in the last 4 or 5 years, and these would be either pure American, or which would be susceptible to blight, or trees that have some resistance built in from our science, we find that chestnut in particular, among the hardwood species, is very, very aggressive in these formerly coal mined areas. And what they do is they go in and they rip the land. Actually, it doesn't look as nice originally because you go in and you rip it one way and you rip it the other way, so you're actually upheaving the land. But it opens up these crevices, and chestnut sends down a deep taproot. That's one of the keys to success. So it reaches for the nourishment, it reaches for the water, and it's very aggressive on these sites. It actually does well in these areas. So we're helping now with a larger program that's Southern Appalachian Reforestation Initiative, what it's called. And we're working through the University of Kentucky and with the Office of Surface Mining Regulatory Unit, which regulates the use of these lands, and then connected to them, the coal industry, to try to recover hundreds of thousands of acres eventually of this land that has really just been sitting there with no benefit to the environment. And we already know from some of the early experiments, Starfire, which is one of the big operations in eastern Kentucky, there are elk in that area now, wild turkey, grouse, goshawks, the food chains begin to work again. So we're very excited to be part of a solution. You know, we're not part of the regulatory part. That's out of our hands, but we're part of a solution to help recover the land. And along with it, come into water purification, wildlife benefit, and this looks very promising for the future. So as you can tell, I'm pretty excited about it.
It has great potential to restore land that has been totally disturbed and really serves no useful function except to grow grass to beautiful forests that are full ecosystems. That's very exciting work. A few years off, but I commend you for that effort. Now, in terms of people listening, now there's probably any number of reasons why people would be interested in learning more about the American Chestnut Foundation. One may be just because the trees themselves are so interesting and so fascinating and beautiful. Other people may have an interest because in the future, this may be, they may see chestnuts in their own areas. Specifically, what regions of the country will be benefiting in the future from your efforts at restoring chestnut forests so that those people can get in touch with you and participate?
Well, chestnut could grow most anywhere. I mean, a lot of nuts were carried out to the West Coast. There's some very large large trees out there, but they're not part of our program because we're focused on reforestation of the original eastern forest. So the main focus for people would be in the east. In terms of helping the overall program, it's just like when the easterners help the redwood situation, we welcome everybody to help us bring these magnificent trees back east of the Mississippi. If they go onto our website, which is pretty easy, it's acf.org, so American Chestnut Foundation, acf.org. If they have grandchildren or young children, we have a link on our site there to Charlie Chestnut, which is a really wonderful interactive youth program. And there's a good storyline here where Charlie the chestnut is trying to save grandmother tree who's dying of the blight. And it gets into some really good science. There's, math, English, geography, history. Very good program. Basically targeted to third through eighth grade, but there are many college professors using this now in forestry programs because it's a classic story. And you can actually adapt our web program to any age level. So I'd say there are a lot of interest. One is it's good for the soul, of course, just to bring this tree back. It's a good thing to get involved in from that standpoint. It's going to be good for the economy. Because this will help displace a lot of the wood that currently is on the market that has carcinogens in it. We read about this on a regular basis. Chestnut will be a natural wood, naturally rot resistant. So for poles and rails and all those things you'd use around a farm or a yard or a ranch, this will be a good material to bring back. It also will help soften the blow, we hope, on the taking of some of the trees from the Amazon as one example. Because it's such a wonderful veneer. This tree is one of the most beautiful woods you can work with. Furniture makers love it. And then you get into the air purification and other areas, including wildlife. If people like wildlife, if they help bring the tree back, they're going to have a wildlife boom connected to it. And so that's all good. There are many reasons to be involved. It's going to make us better as a country. I mean, it sounds like a big thing to say, but it actually is. I mean, if you look at 25% of the forest, if we can recover that at some point with this tree that has so many qualities, we're doing many things. It's good for people, it's good for the economy, it's good for wildlife, and it just feels good.
You know, we hear so many stories about the demise of our ecosystems and the animals and wildlife. It creates a bit of a blight on our vision. Your story actually is a very positive one, and it gives me hope for a much, much clearer vision that can restore beauty and wholeness to our environment. Marshall, again, give your website.
Okay, it's ACF, for American Chestnut Foundation, .org. If you don't remember that, just punch in chestnut into Google or whatever your search is, and we're likely to come up right at the top of the list, and you'll make your way to our foundation that way. It's a good website. You'll enjoy it. Very interactive, very interesting.
Marshall, I want to thank you for adding your voice to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. Good to get together again. Look forward to the next time.
Please help spread your voice of the earth around the world, as each Thursday and any time on the archives, all of us who work and live each day as if it matters, unite our visions to restore the wonder. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.